alternating between sitting down if I feel like it and standing up if I feel like it. Depending on, you know, if I think people are really not paying attention, I'll lurch around and wonder whether I'm going to break my leg again. Anyone who wants to hear the story of how I broke my leg, please hang out close to Sarah and then ask me. So, this nice little thing that I want to tell you about today, and as always at PI, I'm going to make an effort to finish in 15 minutes and fail. This is joint work between me and Peter Turner at the University of Tokyo, a good Canadian. And this is also an opportunity for me to test out every single transition in Keynote. So the outline is really pretty simple. First of all, I want to explain that Gaussian 2 designs should exist, and I'll show you why. Then I'm going to point out why Gaussian 2 designs don't exist. That's really the context. But on the off chance that you wanted some motivation for this, one question before that, I guess, sort of preparatory material, is why do we care? Why would we want a 2 design made out of Gaussian state? And in fact, I suppose that itself requires a little bit of background. So I'm going to start out with what I would call negative one, which is, what is a design? What is a 2 design? What the hell am I talking about? And then actually we'll sort of add this at the very end, and I will explain to you that infinity is not a finite number. They're different. And you knew this, but I'm going to explain that they're different in a new way to me, at least. So you wake up then again. Okay, so negative one. Oh, by the way, please just barge in and ask questions at any time. I don't have to talk to him, do I? Okay, so let me get a sincere show of hands. How many people feel that they have a good working knowledge of what T-designs are? Show of hands, please. Okay, that's pretty much what I anticipated. Marcus, you should be like, come on here. So the idea of a design is that a design for quantum state is a set of states that does not necessarily and usually doesn't include all states, but it looks like it includes all states. It mimics the uniform, unitarily invariant ensemble of all pure states. So that's the gestalt behind it. Technical definition is, I'll actually give you three equivalent definitions. So if I have a design, I'll use script E for ensemble of states, pure states. And it's a design for a particular Hilbert space. It is a T design, where T is an integer. If every Tth order polynomial in the projection has the same average value over the design as it does over all states, according to the unitarily invariant part. So, quiz, what would a first order polynomial be? That's right. It would be
trace of a projector against some observable.
In other words, an expectation value. In fact, all first order polynomials are expectation values. Second order polynomials would include products of expectation and sum thereof. The second definition is that a T design satisfies this property. The T copy mix state for that ensemble, you average over the ensemble, T copy projection, is equal to the T copy state for Harvard. And this is equivalent to the first one. I've just gone back and forth between the function and the state on which that function is limited. And the third definition simply comes from asking, what is the T copy state for Harvard? It's the projector onto the symmetric subspace. T copy. So I take H, the tensor T, T copy of it, and then I take only the symmetric subspace of that. For symmetric and anti-symmetric for T equals 2, for T equals 3 and higher, you have several different irreducible representations. I'm not exploring. So that is the basic background of what designs are. You might ask what they're good for. So a 1 design is just a rank 1 POVM. Any rank 1 POVM is a 1 design. This would include orthogonal bases. And these have lots and lots of fairly boring uses, like calculating expectation values. Then you have three designs, four designs, five designs, whatever, which have relatively few applications. And the interesting stuff is two designs. Two designs are kind of the sweet spot because they are relatively simple and they turn out to have a lot of applications, but the applications are more or less non-trivial. In general, if you're trying to do something that involves an average over all states, there's a fairly good chance that the answer will be you can just do it over a two design. So applications of two designs for quantum information include, well, examples include 6POVM, whole sets of mutually unbiased bases, stabilizer states are a two design, although that's overkill. Stabilizer states are actually an approximate higher design, but they are a two design. So these are, in a sense, optimal tomographic measurements for state tomography. They are optimal process tomographic input ensembles, and you can use them, of course, to average any quadratic function over all states. An example would be variance, delta x squared. This is the expectation value of operator x squared minus the square of an expectation value. So the whole thing is the sum of a linear and a quadratic monomial, which makes it a quadratic polynomial. Another example of a quadratic function of the state is process fidelity or gate fidelity in quantum computing. This is the inner product between a state psi and some channel, noisy channel n, acting on the projector on psi. And if you count them up, you'll notice two copies of the projector here. So this is quadratic. If you want to average gate fidelity over all states, you can just average it over a two design. As a general rule, there are very few things in quantum information that you can do with all states, if you have access to all states, that you can't do if you just have access to a two design. For those of you who have listened to Rob Speckens talk about the toy model over and over again, he's got this big categorization of things in quantum information that are about hidden variables and things that are not just about hidden variables. And the much longer list is the things that are about hidden variables. And almost all of those things can be accomplished with just a two design. Two designs are pretty quantum, whereas one designs include just orthogonal bases, which are not very quantum at all. So that's the background. That's why we care about two designs for various systems. Okay, you might also ask, well, how do we get two designs? One easy way to get a two design is to take the ensemble of all states, our measure. Kind of overkill. There's uncountably infinitely many, and in fact, that is an infinity design. The point, usually, of two designs is that you want some discrete set of states that simulates the uniform ensemble. So one way to generate a two design is by observing that there's such a thing as a unitary T-design. And these are sets of unitary operators, as opposed to sets of pure states, that in the same way mimic the ensemble of all unitaries. And in fact, a necessary and sufficient condition for a set of unitaries to be a T-design for unitaries is that it generates a state design, no matter what fiducial state you feed in. So you take the set of all your unitaries acting on some fiducial state, and bam, you automatically have a T-design for states. Well, so this allows me to generate state T-designs with unitary T-designs, provided, of course, that I can come up with a good source of unitary T-designs. Well, this is where some cool math comes in. There is another equivalent condition for something to be a unitary design if these unitaries happen to be a representation of a group. In other words, if they are closed under multiplication. Then the U's are a unitary design if and only if this representation is irreducible on the symmetric subspace of H to the tensor T. This is almost trivial, because if they are an irreducible representation of some group, then it implies there are no invariant subspaces. And that implies that if you twirl over this group, you'll take any state whatsoever to a uniform mixture over the entire subspace. But that's exactly the condition for the states to be a T-design. Their average has to be equal to or proportional to the projector on that subspace. So this now is quite nice, We have a generic way of borrowing from a big branch of mathematics, which is group and representation theory, to get state designs that we can then use for whatever the heck we want to use a design for. Just find some irreducible representation that acts on, well, some representation that is irreducible on the symmetric subspace of H to the T, bam, you automatically have a design for state, a state design. Any questions here? Okay, cool. So now let me get a little bit more specific. Let me talk about the group that has been used to generate more designs than any other, the Heisenberg group, otherwise known as the Heisenberg-Weil group. But I didn't have a lot of space and I wanted to use a big font, so I abbreviated as much as possible. So the Heisenberg group, which I'll just use a bold H for, is the group, well, for physicists at least. Mathematicians have a much less intuitive definition of the Heisenberg group that confused me for weeks. Physicists view the Heisenberg group as the group of translations on a flat phase space. So this includes shifts in position, boosts in momentum, and if you go around a circle or a square in phase space, you pick up a Berry phase, which is just an unobservable phase. If we mod these out, we get a projective representation of the Heisenberg group, where I'm only interested in observable consequences. And there are two flat phase spaces on which we frequently define the Heisenberg group. The first, and the, well, the second, but the first listed here, because I think it's the simplest, is the discrete d by d phase space that you get from a d-dimensional Hilbert space. This is nicest if a d is prime. We have a representation in terms of d squared translations on this torus, discrete translation. You can go around this way by d steps, you can go around this way by d steps. Or you can unroll the torus and just look at a flat grid and remember that anything that goes off one side comes back on the other. That's actually a lot easier if you used to do programming back in the 80s on the Apple II or the Commodore 64. But yet, see, some of you are nodding and some of you have no idea what I'm talking about. Where this just happened automatically. Anything that went off one side of the screen came back on the other, which was great for writing certain computer games, but really confusing if you were trying to do Pong. So an example of the designs that are generated by the Heisenberg group include the X basis and the P basis. To generate the X basis, you just start with an X basis state, whose Wigner function on this discrete phase space would be a line, of course on the torus, a line is a ring, going around this way. It's invariant under an entire subgroup of the Heisenberg group, but the other subgroup, the one consisting of position translations, translates it around and gives you the entire position basis. Exactly the same thing can be said for the momentum basis. So the Heisenberg group is in fact a unitary one design. The minimal unitary one design, the unitary one design has to have at least d squared element, and the Heisenberg group has exactly d squared element. The really amazing thing, as some of you know in incredible detail, is that the Heisenberg group also generates thick POVM, which are state two designs. It's a great example of who ordered that. It's not actually going to be relevant for what I'm talking about, because I'm going to talk about a different group. To introduce that group, let me talk first about the continuous Heisenberg group. So here we take H, the same group, and we represent it on L2 of R. So L2 of R, as you might remember from, say, undergraduate quantum mechanics, is the Hilbert space of square integrable functions over the reals. In other words, wave functions. This is the Hilbert space that corresponds to continuous variable quantum mechanics. If I take a representation of the Heisenberg group on L2 of R, I'm talking about translations in position and momentum on an uncountably infinite phase space. So this is an irreducible representation, projectively at least. It is also uncountable and non-compact. I can't tell you how many operators there are in this group, except to say Aleph 1. And in the same way, it generates the X basis, it generates the P basis, and for my special extra credit example, I'll point out that it generates the coherent states. This is the first important thing I've said today. If you start with the ground state of the harmonic oscillator, whose Wigner function is a nice isotropic Gaussian centered at the origin, and you translate it all over the place, you get the so-called coherent state basis. Now, this is a basis only in the weak sense of being complete for the Hilbert space. It's not an orthogonal basis. In fact, you have very nearby, arbitrarily nearby Gaussians that have very large overlap. So it's over, it looks like it'd be overcomplete. Interestingly, if you take out any single Gaussian, just puncture the plane at one point, then you actually end up, no, sorry, that's not right. Let me restate that. If you take a discrete grid of Gaussian at any spacing, then it is complete. No matter what the spacing is, the continuous grid is actually overcomplete. You take a discrete grid, it is complete, and if you remove any one of them, it ends up being undercomplete. So the coherent states really are kind of like a basis.
One to get a basis. I thought. You take a lattice and you remove one point and it gives you a basis, I thought. I may be misremembering.
You know, I may be misremembering as well. So since it's not actually important, and I just tossed that off as an interesting fact, educate me later. But keep in mind that business wasn't important, but
no,
it might be wrong.
I think my point's important. I'm
So, perhaps a naive question, but is that a unitary representation?
Is that a unitary representation? I believe the answer is yes, even with all the technicalities of infinite dimensional Hilbert space. But I can never remember without pulling out a textbook what the difference between, it's unitary in every sense that we would ever think.
No, but I'm asking because if it turns out that you're wrong in that and it's technically not unitary, does that throw a wrench in the works or not?
No.
Okay.
Good. So, This ensemble of uncountably many coherent states is used, for instance, all over the place in quantum optics as a measurement to define the Husimi function. It's actually a measurement that we can perform in the laboratory. So it's got a lot of relevance. And it is also used in process tomography, both as a measurement as an ensemble of input states. And a lot of the motivation for this work was asking, can we do better than the coherent states? The answer is yes, they suck. Why, mathematically, do the coherent states suck as a tomographic measurement? Well, the reason is basically that while they are a one design, they're very, very far from being a two design. They're a dreadful two design. They are tomographically complete, but in a very, very unbalanced way. So could we do better? Could we generate something analogous to the ensemble of all coherent states? But that is a two design. The salient feature of the coherent states that's enormously important for quantum optics is all of them are Gaussian. Well, can we stay within the Gaussian states and go beyond and generate a much more powerful measurement and input ensemble for, say, optical process tomography? In order to talk about that, I really need to go back and lay a little bit of groundwork. Because I started talking about the Heisenberg group generating a design. It is a unitary design. It generates a design of states. But the language that I use so far is inadequate for that. Because we're now talking about continuous designs. It's sort of necessary in this case because I have an infinite Hilbert space. But I could define a continuous design even for, say, the qubit Hilbert space. The spin coherent states, there's uncountably many of them, one for every point in the block sphere. This is a continuous design. The question is, well, I can't index these. How do I describe the average over such a design? The answer is I need measure theory. So the mathematicians already invented this ages ago for us. I'm assuming that everybody more or less knows the basics of measure theory, that you have a continuous, optionally continuous measurable set, and a measure assigns weights, not to elements of the set, but to subsets of the set. So I can define a group invariant measure over most continuous representations. I think, well, most, let's say. There are some really horrible ones. If I have a finite representation, then everything is happy bunny. We're talking about a discrete set, and there's always a unique group invariant R measure over that representation. It's just the uniform distribution over the discrete elements of the set. If I have a compact but uncountable representation, then things get a little bit nastier. But I still always have a unique Haar measure, but I have to actually go to measure theory now because the space of elements in my representation is continuous. It's a Lie group. If this is compact, then I can define a unique Haar measure over it. If I have a non-compact group, then there are usually left and right invariant Haar measures, but not always. They don't need to be the same. So things start to get a little bit nastier and stickier. And really, the only reason that the only way that I'm going to use this business is to come back at certain points and say, but this actually does work. Don't worry about the details. We do have a Haar measure. So examples include SU2. It's a compact Lie group, and all of its representations, including the discrete ones, have a Haar measure. On the other hand, the Heisenberg group on L2 of R, the basic group of translations on phase space,
is not compact. However, it does have a nice Haar measure. And it's the obvious intuitive one. It's Lebesgue measure on R2, on phase space, just flat everywhere. Because translations are, in fact, the group itself. And so Lebesgue is translationally invariant by definition. So Heisenberg invariant measure over the Heisenberg group is Lebesgue measure. Yes?
You would just twirl with that, you just integrate DXTP and the function of XTP, is that right?
Precisely.
So this is one of the measure you can use, but it is not unique, is that right?
There are other measures, but this one is uniquely selected. It's the only one that is group invariant.
Is that the definition of Haar measure?
Yes. I am not sure if there are instances where a group could have multiple invariant measures. I've never heard of such a thing, but I also don't know for certain that you couldn't have utterly horrid groups with that property. All of the cases I've ever run into either have no group invariant measure or a unique one. Okay, so that's really all the technical measure theory I'm going to go into. Let me now talk about another group,
the group that I'm really interested in. So I started by talking about the Heisenberg group, which we've used extensively for, say, sick POVMs, and we've used extensively in quantum optics. You can generalize the Heisenberg group because the Heisenberg group contains linear translations on phase space. You just move phase space rigidly around. But that's not the only linear thing you can do to phase space. And in optics, the things you can do are linear on phase space. You have other linear transformations. You have shearing. You have rotation, and you have squeezing. And these are all fairly intuitive. I've put stars by some of them because the rotations and squeezings only exist for continuous phase space. You can't do this to a grid. But you can do shears to a grid. And in fact, if you start with just having shearing operations, you can build a rotation by first shearing this way and then shearing this way. And you can build a squeezing by first shearing this way and then rotating, which you could build out of shearings. So in fact, the infinitesimal shearing operators generate the entire group of linear transformations on phase space. This is the linear symplectic group. Symplectic transformations on phase space maintain the symplectic manifold structure and preserve area. Linear ones are quite simply ones that can be written as 2x2 matrices that act on the 2 vector XP. Yes?
Result of symplectic operations is preserve area.
Because the idea of squeezing is that you shrink in one dimension while expanding in the other.
Oh, I see. Sorry. Yeah. Cool.
So this is the symplectic group, and because it's the group of 2x2 matrices with determinant 1, it's also the special linear group on with two dimensions,
SL2. So SL2 is non-compact. It is for, when acting on real numbers, it is continuously infinite. And when acting on ZD, that's not actually true. So really, I'm talking here about SL2R, the one that acts on continuous phase space. The Lie group is continuously infinite. And if you add in the Heisenberg group, you get the affine symplectic group, which I'm just going to call WSP. All this is a semi-direct product between the Heisenberg group and the special linear group, which is to say I throw in all the generators and see what pops out. This is all the linear transformations on phase space, including shifts and shearings and rotations and sweeps. So SL2 of ZD acts on the toric. It acts on you represent it on a d-dimensional Hilbert space. So on the torus, if I unroll the 5x5 torus into a 5x5 grid, an example of a shearing transformation is this one. I push each row over, and then I wrap it right there to get a isomorphism of the toric. So that's a shearing for discrete variable. And I'll observe that if I start with a vertical line, which is the Wigner function for a position eigenstate, shearing turns it into a diagonal line, which is one of the other d plus 1 mutually unbiased bases. Shearing, again, turns it into another mutually unbiased basis state. These operations, these special linear operations, in fact generate all of the mutually unbiased basis states if you start with just one position state or one momentum state or anything like that. So in fact, this group not only generates mutually unbiased bases if you start with a position or momentum eigenstate, but it's pretty easy to show that this is a unitary 2 design. If I do not assume that D is prime, then there's a different phase space structure. But I believe that if you pick the correct phase space structure, this always forms a unitary 2 design. But if you tell me I'm wrong, I'll believe you. I'm not actually entirely certain what happens in D equals 6. No. Whether you get a 2 design, I'm not certain. Yeah. It's a good point. I don't know the answer. Fortunately, it's not relevant to my result. So this is the one that we're relatively familiar with because we use it to implicitly to generate MUBs all over the place in prime dimensions. So let me then jump to the same group represented on L2 of R. So now the symplectic group for L2 of R is SL2 of R, the real numbers. It's 2x2 real matrices. It includes rotations, shears, squeezes, all these transformations on continuous phase space. And the affine symplectic group is a transitive symmetry group for Gaussian states, which is to say that it maps Gaussian states to Gaussian states. It also maps any Gaussian state to any other Gaussian state. There's at least one transformation that takes you between any pair. That's what makes it transitive. So it's a natural group to start looking at to define a measure over all the Gaussian states. And so the question that I want to ask is whether the affine symplectic measure over Gaussian states is a Gaussian 2 design. In a way, you could expect that if it is not, then what else would be? This is the largest symmetry group over Gaussian states. If we can't use this, what can we use? By the way, it does have a well-defined left invariant Haar measure. The right invariant Haar measure is not the same, though. The point is there is a unitarily invariant measure over this group. Okay. So, yes?
What to say? Are you talking about the full Hilbert space, or do you still want to approximate the two design of all states, or all the subset of, so the convex subset of Gaussian states and the combinations? So does the sign still say mean as before, or is it restricted somehow?
Sorry, does the sign, you say?
The design. The design. True design, yes. So you want a true design?
For L2 of R.
For L2 of R.
For the whole flooding Hilbert space.
Okay.
But that actually, let me point something out. The coherent states are a one design for the whole Hilbert space. But we never experimentally use them that way. Why? because most of that Hilbert space, in fact, a measure one fraction of that Hilbert space, consists of states with more energy than there is in the universe, because it's infinite. So we're always interested in the projection of that design onto some truncated Hilbert space with a reasonable energy. And if you take the coherent states and you project them onto, take each one and project it onto this subspace spanned by low energy states,
you get a one design for that space up to tiny boundary effect. So in practice, that's how we want to use all of these designs. The guys who do Gaussian process tomography can't possibly send in every Gaussian state or even every coherent state. They sample from a low energy distribution. Okay, so Gaussian 2 designs should exist. Why? Because the affine symplectic group is irreducible on the symmetric subspace of L2 of R, tensor L2 of R. Therefore, since it's irreducible, when you twirl over it, you should get an ensemble of states whose average density matrix is proportional to the projector on that space by Schur's lemma. And so the WSP, the affine symplectic invariant measure over Gaussian states, should be a two design. And the proof of this is pretty easy, so I'm actually going to walk through it. The proof is, first, I'm going to abuse notation here. My apologies to those of you who have a PhD in mathematics or who even like mathematics. Try to think like a physicist for a moment. I'm looking at you, Debbie. I know you do, but you think like a mathematician. So I'm going to refer to L2 of X as the space of square integrable functions of X, and L2 of Y as the space of square integrable functions of Y, two variables, X and Y. So take this Hilbert space of square integrable f of x and y, and refactor it, not in terms of x and y, but in terms of x minus y and x plus y. I'm just going to 45 degrees between the two coordinates. And I will call this L2 of x plus and L2 of x minus, just to label the factor spaces. So I've taken two Hilbert spaces, tensored them together, and then refactored them in a different tensor product factorization. Very, very simple stuff. Everybody cool with this? Good. The Heisenberg subgroup of the affine symplectic group, not a normal subgroup, but it is a subgroup, acts only on the x plus factor. Why? Because when you take a Heisenberg transformation and you act on both sides of a tensor product of two states, psi of x, psi of y, it cancels out on x minus y. You boost x to x plus delta and y to y plus delta, the deltas cancel out. The same thing happens in momentum. So this has no effect whatsoever on the difference factor. Furthermore, the Heisenberg group acts faithfully on the x plus factor, so it is irreducible on that factor. Yes? That's right. Thank you. You're right. So what that means is that I can pretty much ignore this x plus factor as I start trying to analyze irreducibility, because if you think in quantum information language, twirling over the affine symplectic group depolarizes the x plus factor, just annihilates it. So I'm going to throw it out and ignore it from now on. And I also know that the Heisenberg subgroup has no effect whatsoever on the x minus factor. So I'm going to focus from now on the non-Heisenberg elements and how they act on the x minus factor. I've thrown away the Heisenberg part. I'm just looking at the special linear group, SL2R. It contains an SO2 subgroup. In other words, rotations are linear transformations. Just that subgroup alone can act on the x minus factor, whose phase space I've drawn here. Here's x minus and here's p minus. It twirls it around. Just the subgroup is sufficient to twirl it around and dephase any state in the harmonic oscillator basis. Or to put that in math language, the irreducible representations of the SO2 subgroup are the harmonic oscillator basis states. They're one-dimensional. There are no two-dimensional, three-dimensional, four-dimensional irreducible representations. Okay? Well, then I just observed that there's also some squeezing transformations in there. And the squeezing transformations mix all of the even harmonic oscillator basis states. And they mix all of the odd harmonic oscillator basis states. So, I've already taken this Hilbert space and singled out a preferred basis, which is the harmonic oscillator basis, just by looking at the rotation subgroup of SL2R. And then I say, well, I know that my irreducible representations of SL2R have to be coarse grainings of that basis. So how can I find an invariant subspace? Well, I would have to find some harmonic oscillator basis states that don't get mapped to one another. Nothing in SL2 of R can map an even basis state to an odd basis state because they differ by the parity operator. They have different eigenvalues of parity, and SL2R always commutes with parity. But you can mix up all of the even ones together and all of the odd ones together. Bam, we're done. Because the Heisenberg subgroup acts irreducibly on the X plus factor here, and SL2R reduces into parity symmetric and parity anti-symmetric representations, and no further on the X minus factor. But so this tells me that the affine symplectic group is irreducible on these two subspaces that are the parity plus tensor everything on X minus and the parity minus tensor everything on X, the parity plus and minus subspaces of the X minus degree of freedom, tensor everything on X plus. Those are precisely the symmetric, anti-symmetric subspaces of the original L2 of R tensor L2 of R. Why? Because swapping the two has no effect on X plus Y. But it changes the sign of X minus Y. That's the parity operator. This is a good time for me to stop. And I mean, it's a fairly straightforward argument, but it's not a trivial argument. So any clarifying questions or I got totally lost questions?
The goal is to
show that the affine symplectic invariant measure over Gaussian states is a two design for states. So they are those states which are generated by starting with any Gaussian state and twirling it according to the affine symplectic group. They form a two design if and only if their average, their density matrix, is the uniform mixture over this symmetric subspace. And that is true if, not only if, but if the affine symplectic group is irreducible on that subspace, because that means that the symmetry group of these Gaussian states twirls uniformly over the symmetric subspace. Okay. So I've taken the tensor product of two spaces, right? And then I refactored it as X plus times X minus. The symmetric subspace of these is the space of all it's the entire L2 of X plus Hilbert space tensored with the even parity subspace of X minus. And the anti-symmetric is this entire Hilbert space tensored with the odd parity subspace over here. The even parity subspace is spanned by all of the even harmonic oscillator eigenstates, 0, 2, 4, 6, 8. The odd parity is spanned by all of the odd ones. That's right. I only care about the symmetric. Thank you. So part two, Gaussian two designs don't exist. Having hopefully provisionally convinced you that they should exist, why don't they exist? Because the projector on the symmetric subspace of two copies is not in the convex hull of two-copy Gaussian states. That's a technical way of saying you simply cannot possibly add these things up to get the projector on the symmetric subspace. And I can show that very simply and concretely. There's two explanations for this. There's two ways to do this calculation in one page. And I chose the more visual but less rigorous way. So the projector on the symmetric subspace is the identity on the, sorry, this is, that should be an X plus. My apologies. It's the identity on X plus tensor, the plus parity eigenspace, which is 1/2 identity plus the parity operator on X minus. Right, so this space here is all the even functions on the X minus component, or factor. I'm going to ignore the X plus factor that should be labeled X plus. If I compute the Wigner function, W of X and P, for the X minus component here, for the subspace of all parity symmetric states, that's a very elegant function. It's proportional to a delta function, delta distribution, I should say, at the origin, plus 1. So I've plotted that here. This is what the Wigner function for the parity symmetric states looks like. Got an infinite peak right in the center, and it's flat but not zero everywhere else.
Because
I've taken the projector onto it, and the projector is proportional to a state, the positive operator. Now, this is not a normalized state because the area under that curve is 2 infinity, but you get the idea, right? This one? This is the parity operator. Its eigenvalues are plus 1 on even states and minus 1 on odd states. It maps x to minus x and p to minus p. So that's what
the only thing that's invariant. What you're saying? Excuse me? Are you saying the only thing that's invariant under that is that Wigner function?
No.
Am I just missing something? Okay, so the Wigner function is supposed to represent some state in my mind.
In this case, it's not a state, it's a projector. It's eigen. So this operator has infinitely many 1 eigenvalues and infinitely many 0 eigenvalues. It projects onto the even subspace, the parity symmetric subspace. So the Weyl transform that takes you between operators and functions on phase space can be applied to any operator. And the Wigner function is the Weyl transform of a positive operator. In this case, it's a projector, not a state. It doesn't have trace 1. You can think of it as being proportional to a state, except for the whole infinite dimensional business.
Aren't there some ambiguities in that statement, impossible to build with Gaussians? Because you're talking about, you're basically saying there's no P function, is that right? For that big function, no P distribution.
Because we are trying to build it with psi tensor psi, with symmetric two-copy Gaussian states?
You seem to have zeroed in on an operator just on L2R rather than L2R.
That's right.
With itself.
So I've argued that the mislabeled X plus eigenspace is irrelevant.
That's right. So when you say that Wigner function can't be built with Gaussians, you're now talking about building a projector on L2R.
Yes, but you should stop there and let me say my next statement. Hold your uncertainty. Now, when I say this is impossible to build with Gaussians, there's a restriction on the Gaussians that I can use to build this up.
Let me take any two-copy state, Gaussian psi, tensor Gaussian psi, for x and y. Gaussian state of x, Gaussian state of y. I refactor it in x plus, x minus. What I find is that this is also a tensor product of pure Gaussian states. I don't care what Gaussian state exactly I get on x plus. I care that on x minus, I only get squeezed vacuum state, where the expectation value of x is equal to the expectation value of p is equal to 0. So take any psi tensor psi for a Gaussian psi, refactor it as a function of the plus and the minus degree of freedom. You have no entanglement between the plus and the minus, no correlation. And you have no net displacement on the minus degree of freedom. And that's what this is the point where I say, you now cannot build this Wigner function by adding up the Wigner functions for squeezed vacuum states. To be fair, you couldn't do it with hold on, is that true?
I have to think hard about whether you could do it with any Gaussians. It's just a question I haven't thought about, therefore I don't want to comment on it. Okay, so the reason I'm ignoring the X plus factor is because I know already that the Heisenberg subgroup depolarizes that one, so forget about it. I'm just going to focus on the X minus. And I want to try and build this Wigner function by adding up the Gaussian Wigner functions for squeezed vacua. Well, those are Gaussians with area h-bar centered at the origin. And I know that whatever ensemble I do has to be rotationally invariant. So I'm going to take, and this is probably where I should have an extra slide, but where is it easy for me over here to draw? So the point is that I can get Wigner functions on the X minus that look like this. Or like this. But I can't get ones that are centered over here. That's not a squeeze back. And I know that my design pretty much has to be rotationally invariant. So let me pick any squeeze vacuum state. Pick your favorite. Pick any one of them. Following will apply to all of them. I'm going to twirl it over rotations, and I'm going to get a resulting distribution over phase space, a Wigner function. Now, what's wrong with that? Okay. In the one extreme, I have picked the unsqueezed vacuum, which is already symmetric. And its Wigner, so if I twirl that, its Wigner function just looks like a Gaussian. It drops off as e to the minus r squared. At the other extreme, I pick an infinitely squeezed state. So here's the in-between case. Over here, I'm going to just, pick one of these deals. And now I'm going to twirl this around. A nice way to see what the result is to sort of draw concentric circles and ask how much weight this position eigenstate puts in each circle. And then observe that it has to be uniformly distributed over that circle. The answer is they all have equal weight, right, because it's just proportional to this little segment. And each of these circles has a volume proportional to r, the radius. They're getting bigger as I go out. And so when I do this twirling, the Wigner function that I get is going to have a density that drops off as 1 over r. Not flat, 1 over r. Those are the two extremes. Everything else is somewhere in between. Behaves like 1 over r near in. Sorry. Yeah, 1 over r near in, e to the minus r squared further out. So I've got basically the convex hull of these two possible distributions. And the point is, they are both decreasing as I go out, and there is absolutely no way to get something that is flat. I could conceivably get infinite at the origin, but then everything else would have to be decreasing. So this is the simple visual geometric argument that you can't possibly get the projector on the symmetric subspace by adding up Gaussian states. Well, this is sort of awkward. By the way, there is a crisper, more rigorous, but more mathematical, obviously, argument that's not too hard, that involves actually explicitly taking this and writing out its coefficients in the harmonic oscillator eigenbasis
and then doing the same thing for an arbitrary squeezed vacuum state. Comes to the same result. You can't get something that decreases any slower than 1 over R, and you want something that's flat. So we just proved a contradiction. Yes. That's right, but except for that spike, everywhere except at the origin, it has to be flat.
You have a huge spike, and then it's relatively flat. I mean, if you look at the last picture, it's qualitative. So is there any...
Let's see, hold on. So we could argue about whether this is qualitatively like that, but let me simply ignore the very center, right? Let's just grant a small region around the center. Cut a hole there. I'll give that to you. Let's build up a flat plane over everywhere except that region in the center by adding up things that drop off like a Gaussian and things that drop off like 1 over R. Again, this is not the rigorous argument. Okay, so it looks like we just proved a contradiction. This drove us up the wall. We thought maybe Schur's lemma doesn't apply in infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. No, Schur's lemma still applies. Schur's lemma says, in its most compact form, if a state or a positive operator is IREP invariant, if it's invariant under an IREP, then it must be proportional to the identity on the support space of that IREP. It's still true. There's only one SL2R invariant state on that symmetric subspace, and it's the projector on the symmetric subspace. So if that's the only invariant state, how do we get something else? What does SL2R twirling of some initial state, psi tensor psi, converge to? Well, there's the catch. It doesn't converge to anything. When you do the integrals, you find that the twirling integral diverges. And physicists, of course, are used to taking divergent integrals and figuring out what they actually integrate to. This time, it doesn't. It's very much like falling 17 feet, looking at your broken leg, and closing your eyes really hard and trying to wake up from the dream, because every time this has ever happened before, it was just a dream and you woke up, right? You don't wake up. This is where physicists don't wake up. It's real life, folks. You can't do this integral. I know I got Sarah's attention.
Crap. That was a tactical mistake.
You talked earlier about capping the energy.
Sorry?
You talked earlier about capping the energy. If you cap the energy, does the integral still...
Yes. Let me come to that a little bit more precisely. There's two ways to interpret your question, and in either way, we're both still SOL. So let me come to that in a second. So the point here, the reason that this is not a contradiction, is that this twirling of a state actually diverges. The average state is not defined, and so it's perfectly legitimate to calculate properties of the average state and come up with contradictory results. It's like saying, let's suppose that something existed that doesn't exist. Well, of course it can have any properties you want. It can be a llama and it can be a walrus, right? That's totally cool. Doesn't exist. Okay, so very briefly, let me try to resolve the mathematics a little bit and explain what I'm talking about. I'll note that it is not the problem here that the measure doesn't exist. The measure is perfectly well defined. You just can't integrate a state over that measure. You can integrate all kinds of other things, but you can't integrate the state. Consider, just as a very toy case, Lebesgue measure over the real line, which we all know exists, and you can integrate e to the minus x squared over it. You get root pi or something. But you can't integrate 1 over it. Diverges. So obviously, we all know that there are measures over which you can integrate some things, but not other things. In this case, it just turns out that the state is one of the things you can't integrate over this measure. The measure is too big. Yes?
You're actually in L2 of R, and you're trying to integrate something that has another square in it, so it's L4.
I don't think so.
No. No, it doesn't. Either that or that's too subtle for me to figure out in the middle of a talk. What I do know is that you can contrast this with Heisenberg twirling and the coherent states, which are very nicely behaved and do what physicists want them to and all this crap, even though the Heisenberg measure, which is Lebesgue on R squared, is unbounded. And so technically, the integral of psi psi over all Gaussian state psi does not converge. Why? Because you could imagine sort of the operator that you get by integrating psi over some disk, and then integrating over a bigger disk, and then integrating over a bigger disk, well, and you get substantially different operator. It doesn't converge to a bounded operator, converges to the identity on the space, and you can't converge to the identity on the space because it has infinite trace. You're integrating up trace class things and getting something that's not trace class, so it's easy to define non-Cauchy subsequences. But, here's where the physicist trick works. You say, I want this thing to exist. How do I make it exist? You make it exist by projecting the thing you're integrating onto any bounded subspace. And then it converges to the identity on that subspace. That's what we really wanted to know. It works in some sense because once you take your bounded subspace, the coherent states that are far, far, far away are completely irrelevant. They have negligible. The problem is there are too many squeeze states. If I take any bounded subspace, I can come up with squeeze states whose center is way the heck over there, but that has non-trivial, non-exponentially declining overlap with my bounded subspace. That's why this integral diverges, even if you restrict it to any bounded subspace. The projector onto the operator that you get on that subspace has eigenvalues that diverge. Okay, so conclusions. First of all, mathematical conclusions. As I pointed out, even if you have a perfectly well-defined measure, there are some functions that can't be integrated. So SL2R twirling is still well-defined. You just can't twirl everything.
The SL2R invariant Hart measure. I haven't written it down because it's a pain in the neck. It's just as well-defined as Lebesgue measure.
What can you integrate over?
Zero would work.
Yeah.
It has three parameters, u, v, and w or something. E to the minus u squared plus v squared plus w squared would be, it's basically Lebesgue measure over those, over the right parameterization, over a three-dimensional manifold. Right? It's just that the state ends up being something you can't. Even the state restricted to a bounded subspace, that always diverges.
There are other ways you...
Let me just finish here, because then people can leave if they want.
Okay, the lesson is sometimes ill-defined integrals really are ill-defined. Sorry, do not pass go. And I will go a little bit further and say without proof that this issue that we've run into probably rules out any reasonable SL2R, linear operation covariant two design for L2 of R. Basically, because any reasonable state that you start with is going to be sort of less than some Gaussian state, it's going to be within some compact area of phase space, and then you run into exactly the same problem. Now, this last line is a little cryptic. For those of you who are into sick POVMs, I'll point out that there's this factorization of L2 of R times L2 of R into the x plus and x minus coordinates actually gives a very nice way of defining Heisenberg covariant sick POVMs. You need to have a state, psi of x, so that when you write down psi of x, psi of y, and then you refactorize into x plus y and x minus y, the resulting state is maximally entangled between x plus and x minus. If you do that, then the Heisenberg group gives you a sick POVM. Gaussian states are as far as possible from this because Gaussian states are almost the only states for which when you refactor in terms of x plus y and x minus y, you actually get a product state. So you could imagine defining a sick POVM state if you could figure out how to get maximal entanglement between the plus and minus degrees of freedom. Such a state would have to be about as well behaved as the Cantor distribution. So you could imagine solutions to this problem that would be, badly behaved. in that horrible, nasty, unphysical way. The physics conclusions are, first of all, that there are no Gaussian 2 designs. You can't even get very close. You can't even get very close on bounded energy subspaces, because this 1 over r decrease of the density that you're stuck with, your density, you want something that's flat, you end up with it decreasing at least as fast as 1 over r, that holds on any bounded energy subspace you want to define. But what's sort of a booby prize, if you will, you failed, but here we'll give you something for free, says nature, is that you can define an ensemble of squeeze states using these techniques that is a lot closer to a 2 design than the coherent states. Basically, this function that we want to be flat over phase space declines for the coherent states as e to the minus energy. Terrible. And if you build it right, you can get it declining as 1 over e. So we can do a lot better for state for process tomography. And this is the first practical difference that I have ever been aware of between infinite and finite Hilbert spaces, as in something that, for quantum information science purposes, really is fundamentally different, not just a mathematical triviality. Thank you. See? Yes. Yes.
And when you're going to the like bounded energy, that's the expectation value of the energy. So that includes three states that have very 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 dense and very 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 long.
Right.
That is so they kind of they have some amplitude on very high energy states. So those are included.
There are two ways. Let me answer your question with a definition that clarifies things. There are two ways to interpret bounded energy subspace. The first is take the original mathematical ensemble of all states, whether it's coherent or Gaussian, and project them onto some disk around the origin of phase space, the first n energy eigenstates. The other is to try and construct something on that subspace using states that are more or less confined to that subspace. Both are valid problems. I have been talking about the first one here. If you do the second, then things get slightly worse in terms of building Gaussian 2 designs for the bounded subspace. You can't beat it that way. But the second is obviously the relevant problem for actual optical tomography, because experimentalists don't have access to infinitely squeezed states. But even if you did have access to infinitely squeezed states and states that were far away, you still can't get any closer to the flat distribution that you need than 1 over r. I don't think for thinking about things like that, that my intuition about squeezed states far away overlapping is relevant, because the only thing I used that to prove, to intuit, was that the integral diverges, whereas it doesn't for the Heisenberg coherent ensemble.
That was a very limited example, only meant to demonstrate that.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm trying to understand what you have to take away to make it convert. I mean, it sounds like you said if you truncate the amount of squeezing as well as the expectation by the energy, it still doesn't work.
It converges at that point. It has to.
Okay.
Because now we have a compact measure. We have a normalized measure because it's defined in a compact space, because you've truncated the squeezing and the energy and all that.
Right, okay. But it doesn't.
And you get, so maybe a good point here. By doing so, you get almost the same answer on the bounded subspace, almost the same projector on the bounded subspace, as you would have if you had taken the big thing and regularized it somehow, and then projected it onto the bounded subspace. The catch is that as soon as you truncate it or regularize it, the measure is no longer SL2R invariant, and is therefore not required to. So then there's no question, there's no issue, there's no contradiction, because we have a non-SL2R invariant measure. We have no reason to expect that it would give a 2 sign.
Right. So the point is that once you do this, you don't get to anything that's very close to a 2 sign.
That's right. Yes.
So I'm still iffy on the last bit there. You said it's the first practical difference between finite and total spaces. And to me, I take your point that the integral doesn't converge and you can't make it converge and stop trying. Fair enough. But to call it practical seems a bit of a stretch because it's practical in a theoretical sense, but not necessarily in an operational sense. So as a follow-up, which you can answer is, what are you missing out on by having the one over R rather than the flat? Like, what kind of states screw up? It seems like it should work for some states, but will totally fail for others.
Work in what sense?
That if you twirl them. Oh, you're saying you can't twirl them at all.
Well, twirling is, again, you're in theory space. I think you're making a good point, but I think what you want to do is come up with an application.
Yeah.
Right? Let me go ahead and answer. I want to know if you had something in mind. The application I have in mind is state or process tomography. So let me start the explanation by asking, suppose that I made the coherent state measurement to do optical process tomography. What would it do badly on? The answer is, it does a terrible job at telling the difference between a Schrodinger cat state and a mixture of widely separated Gaussians. Because the only difference between the two is very, very narrow fringes. And when you take the Hussein function, those fringes basically vanish. Very hard to see them. So that is an the fringe operator, the sign of those fringes, is an observable that the coherent state POVM cannot detect where the rotten darn.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because it lives out in, you know, the large R part of the X minus Y phase space, being very qualitative here. And the coverage that I have of that those observables drops off as e to the minus R squared with the coherent state POVM. Ideally, I would like to measure those observables with the same accuracy that I measure observables around R equals zero. Why?
I mean, this is what I don't get. Like, most of the stuff we do is within some range of R equals zero to get finite energy.
That's true. But so let's go ahead and truncate this at R equals 100. I am interested.
So you don't even have to truncate. We could just say that it's like pick a random real number. Well, you can't do that. But you can say pick a random real number distributed according to some Gaussian around zero.
That's what I mean by saying let's truncate it. In other words,
okay,
we're doing an experiment where we only care about the Hilbert space span by the first 100 energy eigenstates, which means low electric field, whatever. But we're quantum people, right? So we care about something more than just, you know, localized states. We care about Schrodinger cat states.
Sure.
And I say, well, I can do, with my measurement, I can tell the difference between two coherent states that are, you know, 10 units apart. I can tell the difference between two coherent states that are 100 units apart. And you come in and you say, well, prove that you're doing something quantum. Show me the difference. Identify the difference between plus and minus superpositions, between Schrodinger cat states with different phases. The difficulty of doing so, compared with the number of measurements that I would have to make to tell the difference between the coherent states themselves, for if I'm making the coherent state, heterodyne measurement, is e to the minus 100, which is to say I have to take e to the 100 times as much data to distinguish them. If you use the best possible measurement involving squeeze Gaussian states, you still cannot make it as easy to distinguish plus and minus superpositions as it is to distinguish localized states. But now the difficulty is only a factor of 100. 1 over R suppression in visibility. instead of e to the minus r suppression invisibility.
So that's the next to last point, Jim.
Yes.
Okay.
So that's a practical consequence. But if, you know, from the mathematics, in any finite dimensional Hilbert space, if I define this symplectic group, and I use that, I have control over the symplectic group over Bayes space, and I use that to define a POVM, then I get precisely the same sensitivity to every direction in Hilbert space.
Mm-hmm.
Not just in Bayes space, in Hilbert space. And I can't do that if all I have is symplectic control over an optical experiment. So that's the concrete difference. Is it earth-shaking? No. But it's the first separation that I've found that has any practical consequences.
That's fair enough. That's
interesting. So you are a pretty intellectual guy. Maybe I can answer.
Sorry,
what? Also, last question regarding the last comment. To my knowledge, actually, the difference between infinite and finite space is actually the possibility of the entanglement distillation. If I remember correctly, the Gaussian state cannot be distilled by Gaussian operation.
That's right.
But the stabilized step can be distilled by using only stabilizer operation, including the measurement in power basis. This is somehow my knowledge, the biggest.
That?
Well, but I mean, that has to do with how you take the analogy, right, between finite dimensional.
Yeah, but somehow.
Because certainly you can do entanglement distillation in infinite dimensional over basis. But the question is whether the Gaussian.
No, we
it's
what it is.
It's a breakdown. It's a breakdown of the analogy between, you know, Clifford Mills and the Gaussian operations.
Right.
So I'm not. I mean, that's
this,
the difference. But I'm not. I'm not totally sure if it really is representing a fundamental difference between finite and infinite, as opposed to just you're taking the analogy. The analogy doesn't embrace that. It's just a subset of all the operations.
But I think they're comparable, so I wasn't aware of that. I'd have to think more about it.
My question to you, is there any relevance to this effect?
Yeah.
Well, I would tentatively disagree with what Daniel was saying. I think that this is in the same category because it's also related to perhaps a breakdown between the analogy between the discrete symplectic group, the Clifford group, and the continuous symplectic group.
Well, yeah, so following up on that, I wonder, I mean, there was it Marcus had some question about, like, composite dimensions, finite dimensions, and what happens there. And I wonder if maybe that's, I mean, in some ways that's maybe a better analogy to the Clifford group in infinite dimensions, because you can, you get some similar effects. It's not really the same as either.
Yeah.
There's
other evidence that infinity is actually a composite number that's divisible by two. So that is relevant. I honestly don't know whether the symplectic group on composite dimensions is still a unitary two design. It's a very good question. I haven't thought about it.
So let me get this straight. If you just truncate your Hilbert space to some harmonic oscillator, maximum harmonic oscillator axis,
yep.
Then you have a finite dimensional space.
Yep.
You can twirl, you can do everything, whatever you want with that finite space.
Well,
but then
you can't twirl over any of the groups that I'm talking about.
Exactly. So, and in addition to that, you don't have the same sense of, I mean, Gaussian states are not Gaussian. Gaussian states have support over all harmonic oscillator states. So
sure.
You would have to change. I guess what I'm trying to do is trying to say, all right, so what Daniel identified was a mismatch between Clifford and Gaussian, which we just take for granted, but perhaps that's wrong. You seem to have identified something similar, a mismatch between SL2ZD and SL2R. It seems to be at the heart of it, because if you truncate, you don't have Gaussian states anymore. You have to change what you mean by. Because now you wrap around your phase space, your X and P eigenstates don't exist anymore, none of that stuff exists.
So the general statement that there are dragons in the relationship between discrete symplectic and continuous symplectic, between the Clifford and continuous symplectic, is definitely valid. The rest, though, what you're saying sort of reflects a mischaracterization, because the if I take the first 10 harmonic oscillator basis states, and I think of them as a subspace within L2 of R, they have a phase space structure in the sense that they're embedded in the larger continuous phase space. That phase space structure bears no resemblance even remotely to the 10 by 10 or the 2 by 2 by 5 by 5 phase space that I get using a different set of operators. And so you're right that we can't, it doesn't make sense to construct Gaussian states in an energy-limited Hilbert space. But we don't have to interpret these designs as sets of states, and in fact we don't. We interpret them as measurements most of the time. And it's completely valid to make the coherent state POVM in an energy-limited experiment, which is really sort of remarkable. People do it all the time, right? That's what ideal heterodyne detection is. And the reason bears perhaps back on what Daniel was asking originally, what's the intuition with this, you know, there's too many squeeze states thing. The reason that you can make the heterodyne POVM, even if you have access to a small amount of energy, is that the probability of getting a result corresponding to a state, a point way the heck off in phase space, is exponentially small. With squeezing, if you want to make the SL2R covariant POVM, you sort of have to say, okay, let me pick a value of the squeezing between 0 and infinity. Now, I'm going to measure the squeezed POVM. You do actually end up with a logarithmically divergent energy boost by doing so. So you can't do that.
You have to limit your maximum squeezing resolution, right?
That's right. The interesting thing is though, even if you had no limit, it still doesn't help you define a Gaussian 2 design when you get close.
Okay, so I think we should maybe stop there, but Robin is around for
another week.
A week more, so we can take more questions to him at any time. But that's another way.